For inviting me. It's been nice to be here. This is my first time being recorded at a talk, and it really feels like just the right way to finish off a week where we found out that we're constantly under surveillance by the US government. So I'm just recorded everywhere. So hi, Obama. So I'm going to talk about some recent work on applying the conformal bootstrap to n=4 superangulals theory. The main results are in the first paper that I listed there with Leonardo, Rastelli, and Bolt von Reis. And at the very end, if I have time, which I probably won't, I'll mention some cute little results in a related note with the same people and also with Ashok Sen. So just to finish off the apologies at the beginning, there's probably some people who will be pretty bored by the beginning of my talk if there are people who have been trying to follow this little resurgence of bootstrap interest, and I'm sorry for that, but I think it's probably not common enough knowledge yet that I don't have to go through sort of the narrative of what's been going on before getting to any new developments. So to begin with, let's recall the idea of the conformal bootstrap going back to before I was born, probably. So we're talking about conformal field theories. And in a conformal field theory, there's a certain amount of data that you can put in, and then in principle, you get everything else out, where by everything else here, I really just mean correlation functions of local operators. That data is a spectrum of local operators, which is some list of operators which are labeled by a scaling dimension and a spin. And then three-point functions, or three-point coefficients, really, because the three-point function in a conformal field theory is fixed up to a single number by conformal invariants. And so those will be encoded as some numbers that look like lambda with three subscripts telling you what three operators it's the three-point function for. And the idea of the bootstrap is that if you are optimistic and clever enough, then it may be that you can get all of this information out just by trying to solve the constraints of crossing symmetry. Subject to knowing about the operator product expansion. So what this looks like in pictures is that if I'm studying a four-point function, between four in principle arbitrary operators at four points, then in pictures, conformal invariance allows me to express this four-point function as a summation over exchanged operators in the operator product expansion. Where what's happening here is that I can replace the contractions of operator 1 with operator 2 and operator 3 with operator 4 with a sum over operators with appropriate coefficients and functions of space-time dependence. That's what this is labeling. But I didn't have to do it this way. I could do the cross version, which pictorially just looks like the usual crossing symmetry in Feynman diagrams. Of course, these aren't Feynman diagrams, but where instead I contract one with three and two with four, and then there's some other operators in principle propagating in the middle. And these turn into equations for this data, and then the idea is if I stare at these equations, or if I do things with these equations, can I solve them without having had to put in other information into my theory? So I'm going to mostly avoid writing out full equations in this talk because I think the pictures are nicer, but here I'll do it just to give a taste for people who haven't stared at these things before. The structure of this four-point function along with the OP allows me to write down what this thing looks like. So you'll see that the only things appearing, the only unknowns appearing in this expression are the data that I mentioned before. Oh, I didn't write the coefficient here. It's probably 3 minus 4. Sum over the same operators of three-point functions. So xij here corresponds to the distance between point xi and point xj. These deltas are all the scaling dimensions. These are the three-point functions. And this is a function called a conformal block that I'll define in a second. And then, of course, I can just do the same thing in this crossed picture where I do the obvious thing and replace 2 with 3 and O with O tilde. So this is just the same thing with 2 goes to 3. O goes to O tilde, and U goes to V. U and V are conformal cross ratios of the coordinates, so they're cross ratios that are fixed by conformal transformations, which I should know by heart. So these conformal blocks encode the fact that operators in a conformal field theory come in representations of the conformal group. And when I say that an operator appears in this operator product expansion, I really mean an operator which is a highest weight state in some representation of the conformal group and all of its descendants. And in fact, the contributions of all the descendants are fixed in terms of the contribution of the original guy. So the sort of individual degrees of freedom in trying to construct this expression are just the entire conformal families, not every single operator in the expansion. And the conformal blocks are known. They're known functions. That depend, so in principle, they depend on the dimension of the exchanged operator, the spin of the exchanged operator, and also the dimensions and spins of the external operators. I'm not going to consider the most general case in the later parts of my talk where I describe new results, so I'm just going to write down the special case where all of these operators are actually the same, and in that case, the dependence on the external dimensions drops out. And these functions look like this. Where I've defined a function k beta, which is basically a hypergeometric function up to a prefactor, the Gauss hypergeometric function. And hopefully with the last sort of meaningless variable introduction, there's a change of variables here on the conformal cross ratios that looks like this. And this takes you to sort of an intuitive coordinate system. Our favorite things to do when we can move around points with conformal transformations is fix one point at 0, one at 1, and one at infinity. And then you can use additional conformal transformations in four dimensions to put yourself on a plane, and then z is the complex coordinate on the plane of the extra insertion. Okay, so this is the bootstrap setup. You have this equation, and then you write down the same equation with this change of 2 and 3 in the operators. And then you say, what sorts of operators can I put in where I could solve this equation? And it's a hard problem. Famously, in two dimensions, there was a lot of success when people first started thinking about this. Because in that case, you have an extension to Virasoro symmetry, or even larger chiral symmetries. Instead of having infinitely many operators appearing in this expansion that you need to fix individually, they can form into big representations of Virasoro symmetry, and you can ask for solutions that have only finitely many terms. And that gives you the minimal models or rational conformal field theories. But in more than two dimensions, or for irrational theories in two dimensions, I think I've been told it's fair to say that there was basically no progress made since when this stuff was first presented in 2008. And in 2008, in what some biased people might be surprised to hear about, the phenomenologists came and saved the day in an instant classic paper by Richkov, Ratazzi, Toni, and Vicky. They were interested in conformal technicolor models for the Higgs sector. And so they started thinking about conformal field theories. And they asked a totally reasonable question, which is, say that I have an operator phi, which has dimension around 1, a little bit bigger than 1 plus hat, in fact, then when I do that operator product expansion, I get a sum over operators. Can I say something about the scaling dimension of the first operator that appears in this expansion? This is a question which you're interested in if you're studying conformal technical color models, apparently. It was a question that people hadn't really given thought to before that. And it turns out that you can say quite a lot. And this is sort of the launching off point for the progress which has subsequently been made. So I'm going to try to briefly describe why you can say anything about this using only conformal invariants. They didn't want to say we're studying a theory with the following properties that are relevant to the standard model or extensions of the standard model. They just wanted to say, if you have a conformal field theory, are the constraints? And there are. And let me describe in the simplest possible way why you get a constraint. And then I'll explain how you can get more complicated and get better constraints. So the fact is that you can, so in this case, where you have four scalar external operators, you can rewrite the equations of crossing symmetry as follows. Where this capital G is telling me about all of that summation over different guys before, where in this particular case I have a 1 in front. Because in the four-point function of identical operators, I always have an identity operator going through the middle. So I know that this guy is here, and the rest of the guys are up for grabs in the question of what is the spectrum of this conformal field theory. And if I take this and do some simple algebraic manipulations, I can turn it into what these guys called a sum rule for the CFT data.
Why do you keep the points, converting into cross-section?
Sorry?
Why do you keep the points to the parallels to be non converting in the course section? Like, put in everything.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Why do you
question.
Keep the point x12 to the power 2d and not dividing the left and right hand side to make it into a course section?
I'm about to. I mean, in these expansions, in the individual sides, I can't turn everything into cross ratios. But yes, so now if I multiply across and replace g with that thing and write it out, I end up with a sum rule, which is really where the program starts, which is that the number 1 has to be equal to this following sum over functions, over operators in the phi times phi operator product expansion, times this three-point function squared, times some known thing that depends on the dimension and spin of the operator. And I might call this function a new name. So by choosing the right set of dimensions and spins, I have to be able to add up a bunch of these f delta l functions to get the number 1. And these guys took these functions and plugged them into Mathematica and experimented with them. And they noticed something, which is that if you change to these z and z bar variables, and if you set z equals to z bar, and then you take the second derivative evaluated at z equals z bar equals 1/2, then this number is always greater than 0 for any delta with L not equal to 0. And when L is equal to 0, for delta greater than a number which is something like 3.61. And so you've just derived an absolute bound on conformal field theories, because the second derivative of 1 is 0. And so if all of the operators appearing in your theory, appearing in this operator product expansion, have dimension greater than 3.61, then I can't set this function equal to this set of functions. Game over. And that's sort of amazing.
So did you set the anomalous dimension of phi to 1 for this exercise? Or
this
is still a variable?
The anomalous dimension of phi is small in this exercise. So you get a number around this for small. I mean, of course you can play, and then you can continue to play the game for different values of delta. And that's the kind of thing that they did. They then said, once you can produce this kind of a result, then let me scan over values of the external dimension and see what I get. That's a way to get a bound. Now, probably you would, and it's good to know bounds, but probably you would be surprised if there was an actual conformal field theory that saturated that bound, because we didn't have to work very hard. It seems like if you are more clever, you should be able to make that number lower. And there's at least one natural generalization of the argument I just gave. Let me bring this back. One natural generalization of this argument that lets you do better right away. So let me describe that. So I'm going to describe something which is really the same as what we just did, only adding some more pieces. And then if it's not immediately obvious why it is, then I'll try to point it out. So the more general game is to say that I want to find a linear functional psi that acts on functions. In particular, it should be capable of acting on the function 1 and on these functions that appear on the right-hand side. And I want it to be the case that that linear functional acting on 1 is less than or equal to 0, and that function acting on these f delta L functions is greater than 0 for, well, the immediate generalization of what I had there is L not equal to 0 and L equals 0, delta greater than delta star. Where now the question is, what is the delta star that I can push this number down to by being sufficiently clever about choosing this linear function? And this is just finding a way to sort of get a handle on what it means to have an equation between an inequality between two functions. It means that if I apply any function to those functions, then I have to get the same thing. And if I can build a function like this, then that can't be the case. Okay, so at this point, in principle, one has a certain amount of freedom to say, well, what sorts of functionals do I like to study? But there's a sort of canonical construction which has emerged in the community of people looking at this because it seems to work the best, just experimentally speaking, which is to say that this functional will be a sum over some coefficients of some derivatives, and then evaluate it at 1/2. And this is just breaking down the sort of functional condition into a finite dimensional condition based on the Taylor expansion of these functions around z equals z bar equals 1/2. In practice, what we want to do is put some upper bound on the value of m and n that we take. So then we have a finite dimensional space of these functionals. And so for a given lambda, we want to conjecture a delta star, say that we want to improve on that, say we think we can get it down to 3.5. So we want to say, okay, let's pretend this guy's 3.5. So we want to look at all of these functions for delta greater than 3.5. And then we want to scan over these functionals and find out whether we can find one that has this positivity condition. And if you do it, if you find a functional that has these positivity conditions, then you've ruled out the associated type of spectrum of a CFT. You've ruled out a spectrum that doesn't have an operator, a scalar operator, until delta equals delta star. I don't want to go into it because I don't think it's the most interesting part, but I should mention that this really sets itself up as a problem that you put on a computer and not a thing that you try to do by hand. And there are a few subtleties with putting it on a computer. In particular, it's hard to analytically prove these kinds of positivity conditions on these functions. So what you really need to do is discretize the space of these functions. Instead of having infinitely many L and continuous delta, you need to truncate L somewhere. You need to discretize delta and truncate delta somewhere. And prove this kind of positivity on this representative set of functions. And then you need to try to argue that it applies more generally. And that actually isn't that hard, because for large delta and large L, these functions have an asymptotic behavior, which is controlled. So if you check up to a certain level and things are fine up there, then you can get the rest of the way using the asymptotic condition. I'm happy to discuss the methods afterwards, but I think the results are more interesting.
Just say one thing. I mean, they also use these linear programming techniques, which involve inequalities, which I thought were on the lambda O squared, and yet those conditions don't explicitly seem to have lambda O squared in them.
Sorry, the condition that's being used here implicitly is that these lambda O squareds are positive.
Right.
Once you have that, then, I should have pointed that out explicitly.
Simple C's or something that work for maxes. Maybe I don't understand the.
So there are a variety of games that can be played. So some of the work that people have done is on actually bounding these numbers.
Right.
That's not going to be the focus of any of the results in my talk.
Okay.
But there's a sort of natural permutation of the cell structure that works for that. As it is, this is a linear programming problem. I mean, you have a large set of linear inequalities that you're trying to solve for. And so the way that you do this on a computer is that you boot up your favorite linear programming optimizer and set it to work. Okay, so hopefully that's not too murky. But having said that you can improve, you should still ask, well, how much do I improve? Do I actually get to the point where I feel like I'm getting meaningful bounds that are pushing up against sort of the barrier of actual physical CFTs? Or am I just getting, you know, some large number, which I can't have a gap bigger than that number, but maybe it's meaningless. And you do very well. So the first thing that I'm going to show is other people's results, because that's what this has all been so far. If I can make it go. It's not going anymore. I clicked it. And now I got the rainbow paper. It's funny.
Okay. So go to your other desktop and open it again. It might have just been idle for a long time or something. So if you go back, you should be good.
Sorry for the delay. So how well do you do? Well, here's a picture of the bounds that those authors derived by applying this in two dimensions. And what they're plotting is they're scanning over the external dimension, so what would have been the dimension of phi in this case, and they're bounding the dimension of the first operator that appears in the operator product expansion, and that corresponds to the vertical position where the blue line is for that given x position. And as you can see, by doing this with a big enough set of functionals to work with, you get right there. You get right to real theories. You get to the Ising model, to other minimal models. They lie right on the cusp of what you can exclude. Now, the most obvious thing in this picture is the fact that the Ising model is actually at sort of a kink point, and there's been a lot of thought about that, but it's not something I'm going to go into because it's not my work. Okay, 2D models are nice, but these people like 3D models better. So here's the case for looking at the bound when they're looking for the 3D Ising model. Which is, you might think, sort of a fancier theory to get out of your machine. And again, you can see that the 3D Ising model, the uncertainty is, we don't know the exact answer for the 3D Ising model for the operator dimensions, but there's various methods that give you a little blurb there in red, and these bounds are cutting right through it. So you're really getting right there.
What happens if you look at more general correlators, not sigma-sigma-sigma?
So the requirement to apply methods that look exactly like this is that you at least have pairwise identical operators so that you get a three-point function squared here, because it's key that this is positive. Otherwise, this kind of positivity constraint doesn't do anything for you. That's a thing that can be done. The reality is there's a mile-long list of obvious extensions of all of this technology that hasn't been done, just because the number of people who are working on it is relatively small at the moment. And it takes time to get your computer built to do it and wait for it to run for hours to do these numerical things. But it's a perfectly feasible question. So being like halfway through, I think I'm done with review. So the message that I think one should take away from this, and the message that we took away from all of these other people's work, is that using this technique, you can really have some expectation that if you put in sort of the bare minimum amount of information about your theory, in this case, it's, you know, the dimension of an external operator, then this is not just spitting out bounds, it's almost spitting out real values of operator dimensions in conformal field theories, which I think is one higher up on the totem pole of things that are exciting to do. So, enough with that, shouldn't we do our favorite theory, which is n equals 4 super Yang Mills? Which is what we did. So hopefully in about 15 minutes, I can describe the new ingredients that appear, which are mostly technical, but I think it's useful to get a taste of what sorts of things appear. And then the rest will be about results. So our favorite theory is n equals 4 super Yang Mills. I'm sure everyone in this room agrees. But given that we're doing the bootstrap, and this sort of is part of a philosophical endeavor that involves assuming as little as possible about our theories, we want to approach the problem from the point of view of not even knowing that we're talking about n equals 4 super Yang Mills. We just want to talk about an n equals 4 super conformal field theory. Probably most of us believe that n equals 4 super Yang Mills is the only one, but I don't think there's a proof. Maybe there's another one that has no weak coupling limit. So we want a guaranteed operator. The thing that we need to put in to this game is the operator whose four-point function we're looking at. And so we'd like to have a guaranteed operator, and we have one in any conformal field theory. There's an energy momentum tensor. You could try to play the bootstrap game with the energy momentum tensor. The four-point function of energy momentum tensors is complicated. Because we have n equals 4 supersymmetry, you can do better. The energy momentum tensor lives in a multiplet of the superconformal algebra, which includes a scalar operator, which is usually called the 20 prime operator. This is a scalar. Its dimension is 2. Its SU4R representation is 0, 2, 0. And its half BPS, which means that its dimension is really 2. You're not putting yourself at weak coupling by specifying the dimension. Its dimension is always 2. And if we were doing n equals 4 super Yang Mills, this would be trace phi A, phi B, symmetrized. Good. So we get to choose an operator with these properties just based on the fact that we're studying on n equals 4 conformal field theory. And we want to study the four-point function of that operator. JKL. We immediately see one of the things that makes this just a slightly practically more complicated game than the simplest model I wrote on the other board, which is that this thing has indices, which reflect the fact that it transforms in a non-trivial representation of SG4R. So by conformal invariance, it has this kind of a dependence on these coordinates. And then you have some function which has 4 20 prime indices of SU4R. So let me list the three sort of different hurdles that you have to deal with that make this not the simplest case possible. One is that we now have flavor structure. Well, R symmetry structure, treating it as a flavor group. Two is that before we were using these conformal blocks in the expansion, which summed up all of the conformal descendants of a given conformal primary operator. Now we have superconformal symmetry, so we have more descendants. The representations are bigger. So we should have superconformal blocks. And maybe 2A is that there are different kinds of superconformal blocks because of the existence of BPS operators. So if you're looking at a BPS operator, then if you start enumerating the descendant states, there are places where it stops, where it wouldn't if it was a non-BPS operator. So in principle, in playing this game, the CFT data now is not just a set of operator dimensions and spins, but you also need to include the R-symmetry representation of the operator and whether it's obeys some BPS condition or not. And that will change how it contributes to that crossing symmetry equation that I wrote before.
Should you have an exact margin on the form?
Sorry?
You have an exactly marginal.
Yeah, there is. So there's an exactly marginal deformation that's part of a protected multiplet. Right, so I'll say a little bit more about how BPS operators get accommodated in a second. So the way this works in practice, the biggest difference is really the flavor structure, which says that I should decompose this A, I, J, K, L into functions associated to some representation that appears in the tensor product of the 20 prime with the 20 prime, then with some tensor associated to that representation. This is just some product of appropriate invariant tensors that gives me the right symmetry structure. So whereas before I had this function G of UV, which was the only thing in the game, now in principle, I actually have six different functions, these ARs, for all the representations appearing in this tensor product, which are the following.
But aren't the relative coefficients fixed?
Yes. So I'm going to try to go through the list. So this is what we get from flavor structure. However, when we go from conformal to superconformal blocks, what this means is that for a given superconformal primary operator, it will actually contribute to several different functions. Because as I generate the descendants, I change the R-symmetry representations. So there will be a superconformal block is not a function, it's a set of functions, which is the contribution to each one of these associated with a given operator. Now, I think we as a collaboration would have been sunk if it weren't for the fact that there was tenacious work done by Dolan and Osborne to write down the superconformal blocks and then sort of put them all together and see how they generate constraints between the different A sub R functions. So I said that I had six functions, but then it turns out once you learn how superconformal blocks work, you actually have three functions that everything can be expressed in terms of. There's a curly G in there, there's a F tilde in there, and there's a F sub 2 tilde in there, and that should be all there is.
What's K?
And a number, which is related to the central charge. That's right. So we should not be surprised to find the central charge emerging in our equations because we're studying a four-point function which is related to the four-point function of energy momentum tensors by superconformal invariants. So we know that the central charge is going to appear somewhere as a constant. So now we can stare at this. As I mentioned before, different kinds of representations of the superconformal algebra contribute to different things differently. In particular, in this equation, this function curly G gets contributions from long representations, so representations that obey no BPS condition, as well as some of the BPS operators, whereas the F tilde and F2 tilde get contributions only from BPS operators. Now, you can write down the crossing symmetry conditions for these equations. They mix them all up. So you have you have some 6J symbols associated with SU4 when you try to relate sort of the expansion in terms of representations in one channel with the expansion in the other channel. So in principle, you get something which is going to be very unfortunate and complicated. And now I'm going to tell you a fact, because there's no simple way to express the manipulation. But the fact is that after you write all of these crossing symmetry relations down, they give you a single constraint which applies just to the Fs and F2s, which is solvable. So you can actually solve for the part of the amplitude that gets contributions just from BPS operators. You can solve for that using crossing symmetry in conformal invariants alone.
Sorry. Is it related to the following thing, that when you compute correlation factor of four of these guys, I'm remembering this work of Koshemsky and friends, where they fix the stuff that depends on the R charge indices. They had this R invariant in front.
Yes,
and
yes.
That was uniquely fixed, and then they had all these graphs and so on for the stuff that did not depend on this flavor. Is the statement that you have this R invariant the analog of the statement that you can fix this function for 2 lambda?
I'm sure it is. I'm not. It's not clear in my head exactly which work
you're referring to.
But
when there is permutation symmetry, so they were trying to find out, write down the correlation function of four operators. What was the integrand, just based on the fact that because they are on the same multiple as the stress tensor, when you compute loops by lowering Lagrangians, they are also in the same multiple and so on, and then they could use this to compute this object in perturbation theory at a very high order. But one thing that they had was that the overall factor, which depend on these indices I up to L, is always the same and factored up. Which seems to be saying that there are extra correlations between these ARs that are not.
I'm not sure. We would need to talk afterwards.
Okay.
The beautiful thing about this fact is that you can take these Fs and look at how they get contributed to by the different superconformal blocks and do the superconformal block expansion and actually read off the spectrum of BPS operators which are exchanged in this 4-point function. And we haven't put in any information about our theory except that it's n equals 4 superconformal invariant. So there's a large set of BPS operators in this theory that have to be there by superconformal symmetry alone without any reference to a weak coupling limit or taking traces of phis or things.
Is this related to the existence of a limit that other operators become hidden? That the non-protected operator become hidden and then somehow restrict into the BPS operators should solve this equation.
This is related to a trick that you can play to isolate the contribution of the BPS operators, but it's not a limit. It is related to conformal twisting, constructing a. You have to redefine your local operators. We should talk about it afterwards because I don't have a quick thing, but I don't know of any kinematical limit, for example, or a limit on the conformal manifold, where this is the thing.
I meant on the coupling.
Sorry?
I meant on the gate coupling.
Yeah, I don't. If it's related to that, it's not a relation I can produce. So that I've just said in words because while it's very interesting, it's besides the main point of what I'm working towards. So you can solve for the F tilde in the F2, or F2 and F, and plug them back into the crossing symmetry relations and end up with crossing symmetry relations just for G, for this curly G function. So even though we had flavor structure, which could have given you a set of crossing symmetry relations, which were sort of unavoidably multiple equations, you do work your way back to a single crossing symmetry relation. Oh, there's more. Yeah.
So does that also mean that the Lorentz structure of the four stress energy correlator is sort of totally determined then? Because there's only one function. If you go back to the stress tensor.
So, that's a good question. I haven't thought about it hard enough to know if there's anything tricky, but I assume that it's the case. I would think it might be the case, but I'm not.
But is it obvious?
Well, there's only one function g, and g doesn't have any tensor indices on it.
Yeah.
So it seems like you must be able to predict the full dependence on the Lorentz indices.
This,
what else could carry it?
This may be the case, but it's. What do I want to say? It is not always the case that you can use superconformal Ward identities to actually generate. So if you're given an endpoint function, you can't always generate the endpoint functions where you've replaced each operator with any other guy in the multiple that you want.
There are multiple orbits.
There's
the Ward identity.
Yeah, you could get sums of amplitudes.
So for that reason, I don't know if you can get to four any momentum tensors.
Okay.
So you get to an expression for this function g, or a sum rule for this function g. Sorry, it's not a sum rule yet. A crossing symmetry relation that looks very simple, which now is going to inherit a dependence on the central charge of the theory. A is the central charge. And then there's one more step that makes things uglier, which is that I told you that this curly G gets contributions from short and long representations, but now I told you that we can also fix the short representations because we know these Fs and we can expand them in conformal blocks. So G is actually a G short plus G long, where these are the contributions of BPS operators, which we now know. So this is a function that we can write down based on the data that we get by expanding these F tilde functions in conformal blocks. And that means that we get a crossing symmetry relation for G long, which has this piece and also a bunch of information about BPS operators. And you can collect all the stuff about BPS operators and all the stuff and all of this stuff. And what you should think is that you're morally getting this equation again, except now instead of 1, you have some other function of u and v, which represents everything about your theory that's fixed, that doesn't depend on your selection of the spectrum of unprotected operators. And then you're going to get a right-hand side that looks very analogous in terms of the conformal block expansion of g long in terms of the unknown CFT data. And this is happening again. Good. And so you get a sum rule, which the left-hand side I'm going to call f short of uv, which is this collection of everything that's fixed, times a sum, is equal to a sum over the long operators appearing in this theory of this lambda squared for that operator, times actually the same function except that a shift appears in the dimension. So if my theory has a superconformal primary operator of dimension delta, then the thing that appears in this equation is the thing with delta replaced by delta plus 4. And that's sort of a technicality. I don't think it's interesting. And this f short function is that. That is a bunch of operator product contributions of all of the fixed BPS spectrum.
So this is roughly the correlation function if you set g to 0, more or less. It's related to g.
This, you set g angles?
If you set curly g to 0.
If you set curly g to 0, it's
curly g long.
Curly g long to 0. This is,
and the correlation function.
That is that thing. Function. That thing is g short minus g short with u goes to v plus this very simple piece. Okay, so all that is to say that now we finally have a sum rule, which up to replacing one by a very complicated function that you keep in mathematical notebook and shifting these deltas by four, you can play exactly the same game. This is just setting up the same bootstrap program where you can now look for linear functionals. So instead of having to be negative or zero on one, they now have a condition on this guy. And then again, you're going to have some positivity conditions on this. So we can start to play our game. Before we do so, maybe we should, maybe I should finally say a little bit about n equals 4 super Yang males instead of generalized n equals 4 superconformal stuff. And say, what do we know about what we would get in n equals 4 super Yang males? What do we think is going to happen? There are some places where we know how n equals 4 super Yang males works. We know how it works at weak coupling. At weak coupling, I can ask what the first scalar operator would be that appears in this operator product expansion. So in super Yang males, at weak coupling, this is the Kanishi operator. Which has dimension 2 plus anomalous dimension. Plus gamma Kanishi, which has been computed to 4 orders in perturbation theory, including the non-planar correction in many more orders if you're doing planar. So we can also do large and large stuff coupling, where we know things because of holography. And there, the Kanishi operator has become very heavy. Its dimension diverges like lambda to the quarter. And there, there's a double trace operator. There's a double trace operator, which is basically O20 prime times O20 prime. Where I've matched up the indices, which has dimension equals 4. And then, of course, there's a correction if I have finite n, and it's something like 16 over n squared. I'm supposed to know that because Leonardo derived it. But, we don't know a lot else.
Does the 20 prime itself appear?
The 20 prime itself is a
that's
a BPS operator.
Short,
that's right. So if we go to large n, we know what we should get. We should get 4. But at any finite value of n, it's probably some number between 2 and 4. But beyond that, it's hard to say. And we can also do, I set up this condition. This condition for sort of playing the bootstrap game was built for looking for a scalar bound. You could instead do a different spin. You could say that you want the positivity condition to hold for L equals 0 and or for L not equal to 2. And then also for L equals 2. Delta greater than delta 2 star. And by doing that, you can try to find a bound on the first spin 2 operator that appears in this OP. And you can do this with whatever spin you want. It's probably not worth going into, but you can write down what you already know, again, for those cases. And you can say, at weak coupling, I have some guy of dimension 4 plus anomalous dimension, and then at large n, it's 6, and then in between, who knows? And so then we do it. And you find your bounds. And at large n, it's 4, which is nice. It's 4.04 something, but these things are numerical, and you can, in principle, improve by increasing that limit I had somewhere. increasing this limit on the space of functionals I use at the expense of making your computer run for a longer time.
What is the input that gave you four? The two, that's done.
Sorry?
What is the input that gave you four?
The input that goes in is everything.
Just the.
It's that. Yeah, okay. The input, is n equals 4 superconformal invariants, and the fact that the 4-point function I'm looking at is the 4-point function of the 20 prime operator whose descendant is the energy momentum tensor.
And how did the data about what n is enter the bootstrap?
The central charge.
Okay, I just threw the central charge.
That's right. So I can. This is from a Mathematica plot that we released with our paper, which is searchable. So you can scroll over your favorite gauge group and find out what the bound is. In some sense, you might say the most interesting one is for SU2, because that's the strongly coupled SU2 is probably the furthest away from anything that we have another method for probing. And there we get this number 3.05. That's a nice number. I don't have time to go into it now, but you have to play some tricks for how you interpret the contributions of the BPS operators for sufficiently low central charge. And that's why the thing turns around at 2 and goes back up. That's not a kink the way that these Ising model guys were a kink. That reflects a change in the input into the computer machine based on physics. But
so where is 14 minus 4 minus 16 over n squared on this plot or the next?
It will appear soon. Okay. I don't remember the order. So I don't know why I have all of these slides, but you can just. It's the same plot, but you can, of course, look at all of your favorite gauge groups and see what things are. And you can do it for the other spins as well. And similarly, you get the right behavior at large n. You're really getting right on 6 and 8. And then they come down to these numbers, which are new. But the optimistic take on all of this is that the good match at large n should make you feel good about the idea that these numbers you're getting at other values of n are actual values of anomalous dimensions instead of bounds that have anomalous dimensions that are half as big or something. Because this is some sign that this is a bootstrappable problem. N equals 4 is bootstrappable. So here's the large N analysis. You zoom in and it doesn't look perfect. Depending on your thoughts about numerical accuracy, you can have different opinions. I don't have a good answer for why it seems to be easier to get close to the physical answer in spin 2 and spin 4 channels than in the spin 0 channel. But even there, that's not far off.
And also quickly, for this operator, which is this double trace operator,
yeah,
you can bootstrap this value only at large lambda, but not at.
What you get out of the bootstrap, if you get a physical thing, you get the largest value that the anomalous dimension takes on the conformal manifold for that value of the central charge. So I actually think this is interesting. If you think about the planar limit, there's probably people here who have a more sophisticated understanding of it than me. But when I think about the planar limit, sort of all of the planar limit sort of lives at weak G-Yang mills. And then the question of what happens when I take finite G-Yang mills after taking n to infinity is sort of that feels like a tricky question. But you might have imagined that if I set n equal to 100,000, not strictly to infinity, and then take G-Yang mills equals 1, that I would get something that doesn't look much like the planar limit. I might have thought that. And in particular, if we know that here's G equals 0, here's G equals, 2 root pi, which is tau equals I. So here, delta equals 2. So this is for some n much greater than 1, but let's not take a strict limit. I know that very quickly it gets up to 4, because I should be in the planar regime when g is small. So this should, so if here's 4, it should get up to 4 quick. But then what happens? Does it flatten out? Does it increase more? Does it turn around? And I would say that the fact that we're getting these numbers that look just like the large n result at least rules out the idea that it keeps getting bigger. Later, by the end of this, hopefully I will have given you a reason to think that it's probably this one and not this one. Okay, so this is success, but we can be a little bit more clever than looking for these single numbers. Looking for the spin zero bound. This kind of a positivity condition is a little bit silly, because for strongly coupled n equals 4, where I think that I'm getting saturation of these bounds. I know that there are no spin 2 operators of dimension 4, because that's the unitarity bound. The spin 2 operators will have gotten heavier as well. So a more fancy thing to do is to try to sort of move around in the space of simultaneous gaps. So what I want to do is set delta 0 star, delta 2 star, delta 4 star, et cetera, and sort of trace out that three-dimensional, well, n-dimensional, but we're going to do three-dimensional space, and look at what I can rule out, and look at what sort of a boundary in that space I get. And if you want to think about it this way, the conformal, there's some three-dimensional space which is parameterized by the value of the anomalous, of the dimension of the first operator of a given spin in this OP. And the conformal manifold of n equals 4 super Yang-Mills is embedded in this space. The best case scenario would be to find some way to have the bootstrap actually trace it out for you. That's asking for too much. If you have some sort of non-convex thing that sort of bulges out somewhere, you're not going to be able to get in here. It's probably not totally intuitive to everyone who hasn't stared at it for a while, but for each actual point, you are guaranteed that if you draw sort of the cube related to that point that sort of has 90-degree angles, then that whole region is sort of bootstrap safe. And so what you get from an ideal bootstrap, the boundary of the region that you can rule out will be the sort of the hull, the external hull of all of these cubes that I build by putting a point at each point on the conformal manifold and drawing this cube. And so, depending on what you think about the way the conformal manifold of n equals 4 is embedded in this space, you can choose your own assumption about how you think things should look. And then you can do it. And it's more fun as an animation. So this is animated as a function of the dimension of this lambda, of the dimension of the space of functionals that you're going over. So I'm going to show you the way your bounds improve as you increase the complexity of the functionals you use. So dramatic.
This was for some small value then, or?
Sorry. Yeah, of course. This is for SU2.
Okay.
In a moment, I'll show you the equivalent of this picture for the other ends. So if you ask me, that is a cube. Now, numerically, it's not quite a cube. There's some curvature on the edges. And so there's room for skepticism. But it sure looks like a cube to me. And if you ask what has to be true in order for the bootstrap to, if the bootstrap's doing a good job, what has to be true in order to get an actual cube from this procedure? The answer is there has to be a single point on the conformal manifold where all three of these anomalous dimensions are simultaneously taking their maximum value. And there
can
are...
Can you explain it slower?
So if you took... it's better. Let me do the 2D version, because it's much easier to draw on the board. So let me imagine doing spin 0 and spin 2. So let me imagine drawing the embedding of the conformal manifold, or some slice of the conformal manifold, onto the space which describes the first operator of dimension 0 and 2. Say that delta 0 is maximized for some point on the conformal manifold where the value of delta 2 is something, but the delta 2 is maximized somewhere else where delta 0 is some smaller value. Right? So then there's some curve connecting these. I have to be at an extremum here. I have to be at an extremum here.
Conformal manifold is the manifold of all solutions to the Bostock equation.
Here I am, for the moment, I am saying, let me imagine the situation in which the conformal manifold of n equals 4, the n equals 4 conformal manifold, where all the supersymmetry is preserved, so just tau. Let me imagine that the way it embeds into the space has this property that there's a different point that extremizes each of these things. Now, what do I get from the bootstrap? For any value of delta 0, because this point exists, I know that for any value of delta 0 less than this value of delta 0, I can push the bound on delta 2 up this high. So that means that I'm not going to see this part down here. I'm not going to be able to push into this. I'm just going to get a straight line across. And a similar thing here. However, I am going to be able to see this stuff. I can rule out this point. So I'm not going to finish off this cube. I'm going to see this difference. If these are at the same point, then I can finish off the cube because that's what I've got.
So what are the values of the corner?
So the values of the corner are okay. So here are many of these cubes. As I said before, it's not yet a literal cube in the sense that the numerics are still improving, and so it's still rounded off a little bit. And if you want to, you can be suspicious that somewhere in there there's some differentiation between where the different things are maximized. But if it is at the same point, then you're just trying to estimate roughly these values around the corner. And let me just bring up a random one. So that's the neighborhood. 2.94. 5.23,
755. So is the notion that this will correspond to the self-dual point thing?
Exactly. So if you ask whether there are points on the conformal manifold where it's reasonable to expect simultaneous extremization, there are exactly two. There's tau equals I and tau equals the sixth root of unity, which are the two orbifold points. Those are the two places where you have a discrete symmetry.
Tau has a theta angle in it, right?
Yes.
But doesn't the theta angle lead to complexity, which violates some of the assumptions in the bootstrap about reality of OTE coefficients?
No. So we're studying a real operator. It's in a real representation of SU4.
But if you have a Lagrangian with a non-zero theta, then there's an I in front of that, right? Maybe not in Euclidean. Maybe that's different.
You want to say that
whether all these
correlation functions are not real?
Correlation functions holds for non-zero theta. Is that still true?
Yes. Okay. I mean, if you want...
Just it's imaginary in the Minkowski space, but you're in the Euclidean space. I guess it's real.
Yeah, I mean, to add theta, I'm going to forget about writing things in terms of tau for the moment, and I'm just going to add the FYJF term. With a real coefficient, which is theta over 2 pi or something. So there are two places where this could reasonably be happening. And Based on the bootstrap, you have no idea which one. So this is one of the very few downfalls of the bootstrap, is that you can't make that kind of differentiation. And really, in retrospect, at this point, you should say, why on earth did you do n equals 4 super Yang mills first? A theory with a conformal manifold is the worst possible case for the bootstrap, because it has this internal structure you won't be able to resolve. And it's just my favorite theory so much that I couldn't resist. But, it's true that there are obvious, now that we know that the superconformal bootstrap has the potential to be a powerful tool, we are going to go and do interesting theories that do not have conformal manifolds, like the sixth theory of Nemeshansky and Minahan, and things like that.
Would it make sense to fix the dimension of the Konishi and call it the parameter?
Absolutely. So
the gap next.
There are so many. I mean, the sky's the limit in terms of extensions of this kind of thing. I mean, each time you do something, you have to convince yourself over and over again that it works, unless you are sufficiently optimistic in general that you're ready to assume it. You need to look for these indications that there's some self-consistency, that you're getting not just a true bound, but you're getting down close to physics. But modulo those issues, you can imagine ways of trying to trace out the conformal manifold. You can imagine putting in the Konishi dimension and using the Konishi dimension to sort of parameterize the conformal manifold, and then looking for the way something else varies over that. You can imagine putting in three-point functions. There's a lot of games you can imagine playing, and we haven't played them yet.
But what's the difference between putting in the Konishi as a parameter and just scanning delta zero? Not the same.
No. So delta zero for us is not putting in the Konishi dimension would mean changing. It would morally mean changing f short. So instead of calling it f short, this is really f fixed. This is the stuff you're putting in by hand.
Okay.
And this is the stuff that is variable.
But Konishi is not BPS.
It's not BPS, but if you're fixing its dimension by hand,
say it changes the...
So fixing its dimension by hand would be a toughie. So if you fix its dimension and its three-point function.
Okay.
And that's actually, I mean, the conformal manifold's complex or two-dimensional, so you actually want to fix two things to be able to vary. So if you fix both of those, then you can fix the contribution of the Konishi operator to this sum rule. And then you can just absorb it into the known part and then pursue a bound with that given. So that would be the way to do that.
Okay,
so I'm basically over time, but I'm gonna mention just this last thing because it's the paper that we're about to put out. So these numbers that I've said we get are, I like them, but it's hard to check because something like SU2 at the self-dual point isn't a thing that we have a technique other than this, if this is working, to get the value of the Konishi dimension at tau equals I in SU2. A naive thing that you could try to do is to re-sum perturbation theory. And I have a slogan to go with this, something that I didn't think about until I was starting to look at this resummation, is that for gauge group SU2, the strongest coupling point on the conformal manifold has G angle squared n equal 4, 3 point something. It never gets that big, because as soon as you get across out of the fundamental domain, the usual sort of favorite fundamental domain of SL2Z, now you're in a situation where you should use another weak coupling language, and the gauge coupling is actually becoming smaller. So the strongest coupling point is not that strongly coupled. And so you might imagine that if so here's G, let's set theta equals 0, and look at SU2. And if here's G equals 0, here's G equals 2 2 root pi, which is tau equals I. And here's g equals infinity. And this is really like inverse tangent g or something so that I can see the symmetry of S duality. You might think that if I know the perturbative expansion around g equals 0, that sort of basically fixes the rate of growth of an anomalous dimension here. And if I do the same thing here, and if I know this thing is symmetric, then there's not actually that much room for anything to happen. And doing some sort of interpolation in a naive way, maybe that's not an unreasonable thing to do. And so we've been trying that out. You can do something like a Padé approximation, but build in S duality. You can do a similar thing with the Z3. You can build in S T duality, which is an order 3 symmetry that fixes the other fixed point. And you can use the fact that we know Kaneshita for loops to do a pretty serious fit. And here are some things you get. So when you do it for Kaneshi for SU2, the left plot is this one. The right plot corresponds to setting theta equals a half and sort of looking to get to the Z3 fixed point. You get numbers that they're pretty close. That's 2.85 at the for loop. I mean, you see the sort of variation. It's not a rigid science because we're doing naive interpolations. But
the two horizontal lines?
The top horizontal line is the bound that we derived by just bounding the dimension of Kaneshi. And the black horizontal line represents where the corner of the cube was. So if you look at it in something like that two-dimensional projection of this, instead of cubed having squares, this is a rough picture for SU2, SU3, SU4 is red, green, and blue. Again, the error bars are a little bit non-technical because what's the right error bar on a naive interpolation? I'm not sure, but you look at the rough variation as you move around the space of simple functions that you can use. And I read this as generally bolstering the argument that these cubes are pushing down close to these fixed points. It hangs together better than it had to if we were way off base. And that's the end. Thanks. I don't have any specific knowledge. People have played around with using evaluations at different points instead of derivatives. That's the only thing I'm aware of. It really is an experimental science at the moment, and so it's just limited by the amount of time people have been willing to put into trying different things. I think largely what people do is a function of what was done first and not necessarily what's best. So it's conceivable that there's improvement to be had that way.
I think that as you hear the maximum number of derivatives we use, the coefficients of each derivative are not converging, which really feels like the derivative basis is probably not ideal if you believe that there exists ideal function of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Approximate. But that sounds like positions worth.
Exponential, quantum, and even the
have one more question.
Yeah.
Regarding this large gen.
Yeah.
So at the end, the expectation is that if at large gen, Konishi will grow very fast. And so as soon as it gets very close to 4, it bends over and it becomes kind of plateau. Is it what you expect?
Yeah. I would love it if somebody who was more of an expert at large end than me could make intelligent comments about this. My basic reading, so my expectation is that even at large end, it's the case that our cubes are basically corresponding to tau equals I. So therefore, based on the fact that we're getting things that look like the large end result, this leads me to think that for at large n, for basically all values of tau, away from like literally g equals zero, you're basically controlled by the same thing. You have the entire interesting interpolation in lambda happening all like in an infinitesimal neighborhood of g equals zero. Because in the n goes to infinity limit, even large lambda is still at g equals zero, or infinitesimally close to g equals zero. And then as soon as you've moved away from G, like an infinitesimal amount, you're basically in the large N, large lambda regime, and the whole thing is controlled by the usual supergravity. That's my current reading, but there may be people who have thought hard about this from the large N perspective.
Well, strictly speaking, I think as soon as you turn on the tap on G string, then the shield will decay immediately. So what you see...
This plateau is up, it means it's decayed, right?
Yeah, it means that it has decays. So if you want to see this planar behavior, you need to forget about the fact that it could decay, so you're actually following a curve that does not exist in the spectrum.
We are not trying to follow Konishi. We're trying to follow the lightest scalar operator in the OP.
Yeah, that's why I think as soon as you have G, which is different from zero, your Konishi will decay, and so you are immediately on this dimension four operator. So you don't see this.
Okay, I mean, you're, okay.
Related to the dimension count,